Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest episode of The Interviews. And a cracking episode it is, too. We start off with the great Christian Bale, who this week becomes the latest actor to play Frankenstein's monster, or the creature, in Maggie Gyllenhaal's wildly ambitious The Bride. This version of the creature is called Frank, and he's been alive for over a century, and things aren't looking or smelling, quite frankly, too good for him. So he goes to Annette Bening's scientist, asking for her to give him a mate. Enter the recently deceased Jesse Buckley, and soon the two are tearing up the country on a crime spree while falling scarred head over severed heels in love with each other. Oh, and along the way there are musical numbers and a run-in with a matinee idol played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who just happens to be Frank's hero. All that and more was discussed when I sat down with Bale just the other week. This is a really cracking, interesting chat. Enjoy.
Oh, welcome back to the Emperor Podcast. It's been a couple of years. I last spoke to you for the podcast for A Pale Blue Eye.
Oh, okay.
And you haven't been seen since. Did you take a little bit of time off?
It's a funny thing when people ask that when you're an actor, because you're sort of always working.
Yeah.
Just the release dates change.
So you just barrel straight into this, I guess.
Then again, I also, I try to avoid work if I'm fortunate enough to be able to. And I like to sort of wait until something is undeniable, something that I just can't forget about, you know?
Yeah.
And this was certainly one of those. But what else did I do? I guess you're right, but we had the writer's strike, didn't we? We had
it's
the writer's
true.
Strike happen, so we were meant to do this much earlier.
There was an actor's strike
and
as well.
And I do have a thing that once I've decided I want to do something, I just do not consider doing anything else. So even if it's like, hey, nah, we can't get this off the ground for another year, I go then, I wait another year, because I just sort of get obsessed with that one. And if I didn't, you know, like with this, for instance, Maggie sending me The Bride, I thought, this is one of the best, most original, bold. I thought they sent me the wrong script. I thought it was like, oh, this is like an indie, low budget thing. No way anyone's going to risk a lot of money on this one.
Yeah.
But I want to do this one. And then learning, no, all right, there's these, there's Pam and there's Mike, and they're going to take big swings in the guy. And I said, all right, I went in on that. And then I guess it was at least a year between that and us eventually getting started. But in my mind, that's it. I'm playing Frank. So if I had taken another role in anything else, I would have played Frank in that film, because I can't.
Is that
I
how it works for you?
I don't multitask very well.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Interesting. Yeah. So for that year, when you were waiting for it to happen, were you prepping for Frank? Was he already there in your head?
Life happens,
how do you build
the
character?
You know what I mean? You got Adidas shoes to decide about. Are they too old? You know what I mean? There's just your days are not empty, are they?
No,
your days
this is true.
Fill up incredibly. You know, you really have to carve out space to make a film and be able to be that obsessed and obsessive, you know, and isolate yourself. But just life comes at you, doesn't it?
Yeah. So when do you actually start prepping for the character?
Well, with this one, it was kind of a stop and start, but I never really stop. I sort of keep going all the time. And that's just been my nature always. Even with movies that got cancelled and I got told that I wasn't going to make, I still kept prepping on them.
Yeah.
With the belief that, you know, with movies, if you don't, if you don't have the belief, an absolute refusal to admit it's not going to happen, then it won't happen.
You know, this is essentially how you kickstart.
You have to have. It's got to start with one. Hopefully, you know, that spreads, and you have enough people saying, "I refuse not to make this film," and then it gets made. You know, if you have any doubt about it, then there's no chance in hell. It's bloody difficult to get a movie off the ground.
This is essentially how you kickstarted American Psycho.
Exactly.
Into life.
I became completely insane. I was still working out and exercising, and other people had the job, and I still kept going, and look at that, right? It came back around. So that sort of set the template for me.
Has that happened since? Apart from
not
that
in
movie
quite
and maybe
the extreme
this?
Of that, but I certainly have had other things where, it kept getting delayed. But I just kept on, prepping for it. The Machinist was one of those, like that kept on getting delayed. And oh my God, was I getting hungry? But I just kept saying, no, it's going to happen. I've got to keep doing this. And to varying degrees, it happens on almost everything. It's rarely a film that isn't a bumpy ride.
Mm. So in a way, I mean, obviously you've worked with Maggie before. I want to talk about that, because that must be an interesting experience working with someone as an actor and then years later being directed by them.
Yeah.
But before we do that, did you, in a sense, recognize a kindred spirit in Maggie as well? Because, you know, she was waiting for this movie to be made, and she was sitting around, I guess, being very, very passionate and very, very fanatical in a way about getting this movie made.
Yeah. No, she's a risk taker because she did get offers on this. And when she discovered that they were gung-ho initially, but then started to want her to adapt things. And she never wanted to make a morality tale, you know. And when she started hearing requests for, can you start to make them a bit more likable in these certain scenes, or can you just make them good, you know, and unequivocally good, you know, like that, she didn't like it. And she would call me up and say, you know what, no, I'm leaving. And it was great. I loved hearing her say that because, you know, hey, it's absolute do or die. Like, she could never get anybody back in her ever again. But she was bold enough to say if she didn't get to make it the right way, she wasn't going to make it.
You know?
And then you got people who were being bold and brave, like Pam and Mike from Warners right now, who I think are recognizing, you know, we have slightly different ideas about how much we're in the death throes of theatrical release movies. I'm really quite pessimistic, but strangely optimistic at the same time, because I think we're going into a period where it's going to kind of just crater. Mm. But in that case, you're going to get people who want to make movies, not because of money, not because of fame, but because they love telling stories. And so you're going to get some of the best storytellers ever come from that. And then hopefully at some point, some kids who are used to doing all of the, I agree, fantastic, interactive, you know, art forms, they'll suddenly remember, oh, you remember when they used to just tell stories, one person's idea of a story, and it'll kind of revive. Pam and Mike are a bit more optimistic than that. And they look at that. They're doing very bloody well. You know, they're taking big swings on directors or filmmakers such as Maggie and the other likes, and they're doing really well with it. So all the best to them. I hope that they are right and I'm wrong.
Well, I hope you're wrong as well, to be honest. But because it's interesting, because
either which way though, I think it's an interesting time.
You know? It is an interesting time, but I think you're right. The studios are becoming a little bit more conservative, I would say, with backing filmmakers. You've worked with a number of filmmakers who have gone all out to get their visions on the screen, whether it's Chris Nolan or Michael Mann or Spielberg, and now Maggie. And it feels to me that studios are more and more reluctant to really back people like that. And when I see something like this, which, but as you say, is a bold swing.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. They're doing it and they're backing it to the hilt. And Maggie really, you know, ended up landing on her feet, and she did an amazing job. You know, when you start to get a bit more money involved in movies, you start getting a lot more demands and pressure, and all of a sudden last minute jitters and people, you know, covering their own asses, you know, demanding that you change things. And she just stuck to her guns all the time. You know, have you met her?
Yes.
Very soft-spoken, but don't let that fool you at all, you know?
I'll tell you said that. And, what was that like, though, that experience of working with her as an actor and then years later being directed by her?
You know, she's so good at understanding, like, maybe what an actor needs of when just leaving them alone to create and let them own their own ideas. But then also just sort of coming in, little whispers in the ear of maybe try this. Absolutely superb, you know, really, really, really great with it. And then also very original with her take on the filmmaking, you know, as a director, and the kind of wonderful confidence where she would occasionally just sit back and say, you know what, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And I love it when a director has the confidence to be able to say that, because you immediately feel like, oh, now we're a team. Now it's a real collaboration. I'm not just an actor for hire. You know, and I love that. I want to roll my sleeves up and get dirty with it. And she wants to know, I don't know, what do you think? You know, and obviously she's very strong-minded. Once she makes a choice, oh, that's it. That's what we're doing. But I loved that about her. And I felt that was one of her biggest strengths.
So in terms of that, I mean, do you come to the set with your performance? How fixed is it when you come to the set, when you're...
I like the, you know, I mean, look, you've always got to read the director, right? You've got to understand what language is this movie, you know, and you got to be speaking that language. Otherwise, you're just sticking out like a sore thumb. So you got to understand the language, the tone of it, the rhythm, that's something you can talk about, but you really don't start learning until the first couple of days filming, where you actually see it on its feet and really get what they mean, you know, and you have directors pull you aside, which I've had go, what the hell are you doing? And you realize, oh, I thought I knew what you meant, but clearly I don't. And then, but there's nothing like just putting it on its feet to understand. And when they say, no, not that, yes, that, oh, now I get it. Feeling it out, you know, is so much better. But with something like this, you know, you do your work, you do the work, you really figure out the characters, and then you just see what happens, you know? And yeah, of course, you've got a script and there's a destination in most scenes, but you kind of ignore that, you know, because you can tell when someone's trying to get somewhere instead of just as we're talking now, we don't know what the next thing's going to be. You just sort of ride it, you go along with it. Yeah. And that's much more Maggie's cup of tea.
Interesting. And of course, you also bring in your other actors and acting as reacting and
never know
bounce
what
off people.
Do. Exactly. Yeah. Fantastic.
And when Jesse's extraordinary in this
extraordinary,
as well.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give too much away, but there's more than one performance, shall we say, within the same physical space.
Three performances. Yeah. I think you can say that. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, and that's the to me, the truly magnetic relationships in the story, and that's the terrifying love story of this woman who's kind of been given a second chance with wide open eyes, seeing the absurdities of life and saying, no, I don't think so. No, I'm not playing the game anymore. Yeah. I don't care what the consequences are. I'm mad as hell, and I'm bloody going to do what I want to do. And she's had so much life experience, the exact opposite of Frank. She's had too much experience with men, and he's had zero experience with women, but he's got all this experience with murder.
Yeah.
And you get these two, you know, unlikelies coming together, and he just falls, you know, head over heels in love with her, because he would have taken just a jam donut. He would have been happy sitting next to for the rest of his life. And instead, he gets just one of the most brilliant, authentic, sincere, sharp, you know, electric women.
It shakes him out of something he's been hiding for years, right? So he's been hiding for years, and it kind of shakes him out of this.
Exactly, yeah. Just gives him this boldness of, like, you know, and you know, hey, look, you know, he might be over 100 years old, but they're adopting the live fast, die young, you know, approach to life.
And leave a stitched up corpse.
Yeah, leave a very smelly corpse that maybe could be reanimated. Yeah,
that maybe could be reanimated, absolutely. Who was your Frankenstein growing up? Your Frankenstein's creature.
Karloff. Yeah. I don't think you can top him. I tried looking at everything else, and, you know, you've obviously got the Mel Brooks, you know, Young Frankenstein, which is fantastic, and we give a little bit of a nod to that, you know, in the film. But it's Karloff, and I know that he's not written how Mary Shelley described it, but regardless, I cannot stop just seeing Karloff always for me. So for Frank, we wanted to kind of incorporate parts of Mary Shelley, incorporate parts of Karloff, but kind of say, hey, you know what Karloff got right? When he interviewed witnesses who had actually met Frank, they were right about the scar. But they got it wrong about the flat head. That was silly. What was that all about? No, it was his hairstyle looked flat. He wasn't 8 foot. He was a man. There's no man that's 8 foot. He was 6'5". But when people were cowering in terror, he looked much bigger, you know, like that. Yeah. And likewise with Mary Shelley, you know, there was the Italian guy, Galvani, doing all the experiments and whatnot. And that she kind of got some of it right, but not all of it right at all.
Interesting. Because there's also a bit of a nod with Frank to Karloff. Yes, the flat head, etc. But also the... No one's been able to go near the bolts.
Took away the bolts. Yeah,
you can't, because for legal reasons, you can't go near the bolts.
Exactly.
But they're there.
Yes,
they're there.
But he sat out there, you know, with a hacksaw, taking them off. Yeah.
And as you say, there is a nod to Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You and Peter Boyle, I think we can say this, are now the only two people who played the Frankenstein's creature, Frank, to have sung Putting on the Ritz.
Love it. I know. I love that opportunity. You know, it's one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever. And to get to find a place where we could chuck that in was wonderful.
How was
totally, it? Totally anachronistic, and we just didn't give a shit.
No, rightly so.
Yeah.
Rightly so. Mel Brooks didn't give a shit. So why not? Just go for it. What was it like filming that sequence? Because that whole sequence is extraordinary.
Man, like at the end of each day with the prosthetics, they would slice me open at the back and you'd get about between a pint and a litre of just sweat dripping into the glass. And then we would all share it and drink it just as a little camaraderie thing.
There's a really interesting wrinkle in that sequence and throughout the movie as well, that Frank is in love with cinema. And he's in love with one actor in particular.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
And he projects so much onto this guy, Jake Gyllenhaal's character.
Yeah. Right? Now, I love that element of it because, of course, when you've got nobody, then you can find somebody in cinema. It's his best friend. It's his father figure. It's his role model of what it means to be a gentleman, of what it means to be a real man. It's when it's who he imitates when he first arrives and meets Euphronius, played by Annette Bening.
Yeah,
it's who he's trying to imitate, and how he feels he should behave when he first meets the bride, because nobody's ever taught him at all. And then he realizes that's not what the bride is looking for. And in many ways, this kind of protest dance that comes out of meeting his hero.
Yeah, yeah.
Upon which time Frank. You know, he probably still doesn't get it, but we all see, he's a stalker, isn't he?
Yes.
Yes, he loves this man. Yes, he feels less alone. Yes, he's had nourishment in his life because of Ronnie Reed, and it's healthy beyond belief. It's a wonderful thing, and it's what cinema really can provide. But he turns up, and he's a big, smelly stalker. Who doesn't seem to comprehend that, of course, the guy on the screen cannot know him.
Yeah.
And even more, cannot be his friend and know all about him. And it just destroys Frank. He doesn't get it. But it's when we see the birth of the real Frank coming through and the bride recognizing that as well and her loving it. And it's a protest dance. And there's a bit that I love in it that I put in there, which was one time I was at a zoo and these chimpanzees were taking their shit and throwing it at me. and so we do a bit where we kind of do that and we chuck it. So all of it means something. And at the end of it, Frank has become his own man.
Yeah.
He still adores Ronnie, but he's been disappointed and he knows it's not the best friend, the father figure that he always thought it would be.
Yeah.
And the bride is now sparking a revolution through both of them actually finding their own identities.
In a way, they say never meet your heroes, and that scene is illustrative of that.
But
at the same time, it puts them on this path. So maybe you should meet your heroes. Have you had a hero that you've met that where the old adage has been disproved, where it was good to meet your hero?
I wouldn't say he was a hero, but certainly Gary Oldman was someone who I looked to as an actor who was just incredible and someone I hope to be able to be something like that, you know, one day. Because I'd also loved watching Steve McQueen, but that's unattainable.
Yeah.
He's so fucking cool. It's just like, oh, give it up now. Come on, mate. I'm in a little small town in England. Like, it's never going to happen. So that was a great lesson in, all right, there are some people that can be movie stars and just going, yeah, I'm not going to manage that one. Gary, I looked at and went, he's a really good actor. I never needed to meet him. I did. No disappointment there. I've worked with him. No disappointment. Yeah. He remains kind of my main man in terms of why. And who I wanted to aspire to. But I do think for most people, I see the look in people's eyes when people meet me. And I know, I just disappointed them. Oh, God, it's dawning on them. They never should have done this, right? They should have left it on the silver screen. They shouldn't have done it.
You might be reading too much into it.
And so I know, I'm like, I'm happy. I just want to know their work. I just want to listen to their music. I want to see their artwork. I want to read their book. I want to watch their film, but I actually actively try to avoid me.
Avoid meeting or being met by. That's the thing to go. Yeah, that's the thing to do. Very last thing, Christian, real quick. I believe Heat 2 is in your immediate future. Talking of heroes, I adore Michael Mann. I adore that film.
Yeah,
film.
Dorian 2. We've been meaning to work together for many, many years, and this is going to be a cracker. Yeah, really looking forward to it.
That was Christian Bale, and The Bride is out in cinemas across the country. And if you want more, The Bride interviews the bride herself, Jessie Buckley, and the film's writer-director, Maggie Gyllenhaal, will be on this week's Mothership Empire podcast, which is also out on Friday. Well worth a listen, that one. The interview, not the podcast as a whole. We haven't recorded it yet, but I assume that will also be well worth a listen. This week also sees the release of Pixar's latest movie, Hoppers, in which a young woman called Mabel finds herself, for reasons far too complicated to go into here, transported into the body of a robot beaver, and finds herself making friends with a community of animals led by another beaver called King George. Now, I know what you're thinking, but as the movie itself says, this is nothing like Avatar. And that's true, because honestly, you're not going to believe the wild turns that Hoppers takes. But at the center of the mayhem at all times is a rather sweet friendship between Mabel and King George, and so I was delighted to talk to the actors voicing them, Piper Curda and Bobby Moynihan, formerly of SNL, earlier this week. And this one, folks, is one of my favorite interviews in a while. I mean, obviously, I love all our interviews equally, but some I love more equally than others, and this was just a ton of fun. Oh, and Comedy Bang Bang fans will be glad to know I asked Bobby Moynihan about Forville. And if you've no idea what I'm talking about, then seek out the episodes of that show where he plays Forville, a stabby little orphan, opposite the host Scott Aukerman and Paul F. Tompkins as Lord Andrew Lloyd Webber. And prepare to lose your damned minds. Oh, in fact, you know what? I'll wait for you to listen to them and then come back here to listen to this. They're about 2 hours long each. There's four of them, so I'll just drop in 8 hours of silence now. Hey everyone, it's Chris here, just dropping in real quick to say that we've been told by the powers that be that dropping 8 hours of silence into a podcast is frowned upon. I tried to negotiate, I tried to reason with them, but the most they said I could drop in is 8 seconds of silence. So here it is, 8 symbolic seconds of silence. Okay, now that's over, here is Piper Curda and Bobby Moynihan. This one is pure joy. Enjoy.
Piper, Bobby, yes. Piper, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, when did you guys meet?
Just now.
6 seconds ago.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll leave. If you want to get to talk amongst yourselves.
No, we met at D23.
Okay.
We did not record together. We met after we were done recording. Or maybe we weren't done? No, we were done because they had to show the movie.
We were done, yeah.
Yeah, we were done.
Okay.
August of last year.
Yeah.
That is so weird.
Yeah.
I mean, the way that animation works opposed to live action acting. What do you call that? In-person acting?
I think I've also just referred to it as live action acting.
Live action
or just acting.
Just acting.
It's funny.
But then that means that animation acting isn't acting, right? I don't want to make it sound like it's not.
But they call it voice acting.
Voice acting rather than acting.
Where you just send your voice and you leave your body at home.
Mm-hmm.
Which
I often do that.
Sometimes you have to.
Bobby today is represented by his iPhone, which he has sent over.
Correct. My avatar, my iPhone. Just a little, I wish that would be the best.
Pre-recorded all your lines. A bit of improv in there, just in case you guys want to use some extra. But it's wild because you genuinely don't get to meet, for the most part, some animated movies do this where they get people together and they record in the booth, but it's weird because you've got no idea who you're acting opposite.
Yeah.
I remember they would play your lines and I would react to them, sometimes,
Was it me or was it the scratch?
Both.
Sometimes.
Yeah, it's like if they had your lines available, they would play them, it changes, but it is crazy. It is crazy. We haven't met half the cast.
Yeah. I've met him and John and Dave. And then I met Nicole at the red carpet very, very briefly. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Wow. So you haven't had a chance to go out for like a big cast dinner or anything yet?
No, I mean, like, well, they're all, the cast is amazing. Yeah. They're all such heavy hitters. They're all so busy. They got other stuff going on, you know? So
they can set 2 hours aside.
But no, they were all, I mean, so many of them were at the premiere, but with the way that it works when you're in the movie, which I just, I guess, was not familiar with. You're just running around and talking to different outlets and doing different things that you just like don't end up actually meeting these people in the one.
I often see actors and go, they go like, hey, we were in a movie together. And I go, oh, no way.
Yeah. So,
and then you get to do the voice and so that triggers the memory for you.
Never.
Yeah. Amazing. Listen, I never do this. I never normally do this. This is an audio podcast, we are recording it obviously on video.
Are you going
to talk
about
me? I have to talk about your outfits because, Piper, this is astonishing.
Right?
This getup. Is that a cricket jumper? What is that?
This is Tom Brown, who is a lovely designer that I have only dreamt of wearing. And my amazing stylist, Amanda Lim, pulled this outfit for me, and I'm just having a great time. You could ask me the worst questions in the world, and I'm just happy I'm wearing this.
Oh, I plan to ask the worst questions in the world. I've given you a little preview already of my questions. I know nothing about anything.
But thank you. Bobby's jumper game has been very strong whole tour.
I like everyone calling it a jumper in England.
Well, we're in the UK.
Yeah. So. A jumper talk.
You got to do it right. It's pavement,
which also
not sidewalk.
The name of the movie in France.
Jumpers, yes, this is true.
What?
In France and in Italy, the movie is called
Hoppers.
Jumpers.
Called
I don't
Jumpers.
Know about France, but I know in Italy, my friend who's Italian told me that they don't, like H's, they don't pronounce H's or they're silent in
they refuse,
in Italy. So yeah, they
it's an ideological thing. They just say H's.
And so to make up for that, they call it Jumpers instead, which is interesting.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Blimey O'Reilly. Okay, so is that a phrase you've heard before, by the
never
way?
Met
Blimey
no.
O'Reilly?
No,
okay.
Never.
I'm going to start using it,
take it back to the States.
Oh, I will. Yeah.
It'll be sweeping the nation before
by Monday.
Hoppers 2, Blimey O'Reilly.
Sorry, Jumpers 2.
Sorry, yeah. My bad.
Because, Bobby, that's a big old cobra.
Thanks, I made it.
You, of course, are...
I sold this myself. Thank you.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
If true.
It's the truth.
It's not the truth. I didn't think it was the truth.
That's okay.
Yeah. Do you want to apologize to the people for lying to them?
No.
Okay, that's fine. Worst questions. I'm going to hold your feet to the flames until you apologize. It's a lovely jumper. You, of course, play a beaver, the natural enemy, I'm guessing, of cobras. George would not last 5 seconds. In a bout with a cobra.
I don't know. I think he might charm
them. Yeah.
I think he might, you know, he may not be the most muscly guy in the world,
you know,
but he could talk a snake into not eating him easily. King George.
Well, there is that one part.
You think?
Yeah.
Also,
a lot of pent up rage in there, that King George.
Oh, probably, yeah.
If a snake attacks me, I'm winning.
Right.
I'm not going down easy. And I am King George.
There is
now I'm mad at snakes.
There's a part in the movie where King George has a conversation with a snake. Do you remember this?
No.
Do you?
I saw the movie yesterday. Yes. Let's say yes.
Yeah, I mean, cut this out if you don't want it. But you are in the mouth of a snake, remember? And I jump on it and he like spits you out.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So would venture to say you're wrong. Without Mabel. Without Mabel's
features.
Help.
Let's see these bonus features where he pile drives, elbow drops on a snake.
But anyway.
Pick up a snake, tie.
Sorry, improv's all yes and. You're totally right. You would win.
Very much so. Even if it means that your character dies
in
the course of the improv.
If it happens, it happens.
Does this mean know that your sympathies lie with snakes, Bobby?
Oh.
Wow.
Because you're
putting me on the spot here.
I am. I told you I was going to ask the worst questions in the world.
I don't like you. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm 100% kidding.
It's fine.
No,
a lot of people have that reaction.
I will say I do have I definitely have a bigger place in my heart for beavers now than I thought I would.
Did you have a place in your heart for beavers at all before that?
No, I didn't. And now I do because of this movie and because Daniel Chong made me realize that we should care more as people. And now I do. And that's the truth.
Mm-hmm. Because that is a big part of the message of the film, you know, that we're all basically screwed unless we do start paying attention to animals and to the environment.
Each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We learned a little bit about ourselves today.
You know what? I love you.
Thanks, man.
You got it.
I'll be 150 pounds for this session.
Yeah.
And, wow. Just bill that to your insurance.
Wow. You're coming over here and you're charging those prices from the off immediately?
Ari, listen.
I can get psychoanalyzed for 20 pounds. I mean, it's terrible psychoanalysis. I can't even say it. That's how bad it is.
We're in a dying industry, you're going straight right? We need to make money somehow. Anyway.
Wowzers.
I'm not licensed.
She's good at it. You gotta be charged for what you're worth.
I should say I'm not licensed for the
worst of all. That's why I try to charge extra. Smart. So
I'm gonna have to pay for those.
Exactly. I gotta cover
lawyers. Yeah.
I'm gonna look at my list of questions now. So
very nice.
I forgot to write them down.
Yeah.
Oh, God. But today you mentioned improv there.
Oh, you know, did I?
This man knows his way around some improv as well. So
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've heard comedy.
I've done it. Yeah,
yeah. I know you know your stuff.
All right.
I know you know your stuff.
He's going to tackle me at some point. You're going to attack. You're going to tackle me.
I've never felt this aggression towards him before. This is wild, Bobby.
Are you beefing with our
I don't. I just think it's funny to start fights with interviewers.
Yeah.
You'd snap me like a twig.
Okay. Plus, Piper would join in. That's not fair.
It's the only time I'm tough. During Pixar movies.
Good question. I'm is scrappy. Like there are about what, 5-6 other people in this room?
Mm-hmm.
Which side would they be on?
Well,
whose side I would they be
yeah.
on?
Contractually. No.
That's up to them. He doesn't really care at all.
He's an idiot. This guy's not even paying attention.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, they can all fight. No problem. I'm on my phone.
He looks up at the end of the interview, just a pile of dead bodies. What happens?
So improv.
Improv in the booth when you were doing your animation, voice acting.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a lot?
Not so well, you know, actually there were a couple parts where it's just written a little chaotically. So they're like, and then just throw in whatever you want, you know. So there's the part when Mabel first becomes a beaver and mm-hmm. is sort of like talking to the animals and is like, you know, hearing them speak and starts running through the glade and is like, oh, what's up with all of you? Like, hi. That was one of the parts where they were like, just say some stuff. And I was like, okay. And like, there's literally a part that they put in the movie where I go, you're a deer. And that was like at the very end of like 20 or 30 seconds of improv-ing where I was like actually saying some maybe good or interesting stuff. And then I was running out of stuff. So I was like, hi, duck. Hi, deer. You're a deer. And that's just in there now. So there were a couple moments like that where they were like, just, you know, go
did you
off.
Go R-rated? Did you throw a few F-bombs in there?
Oh,
just,
absolutely.
You know, getting carried away in the heat
yeah.
of the moment?
It was yeah. like, I was like, if I say it enough times, maybe they'll put it in there. so every other word. Yeah. But no, yeah. So, but I don't know. With you, I mean, imagine.
I improvise a great deal. I like to do it, but I don't have to with
it's
Daniel.
A shame he's no good at it.
I don't have to with Daniel. He knows exactly what he wants. And when I go to work with Daniel, I a little bit feel like I go, he's better at this. I'm gonna let him take the lead. There are times when I go like, I got this. And let me do what I do best. Mm. And I don't do that with Daniel. I kind of go like, how do you want me to do this? And that helps me a great deal. So I didn't improvise a lot. But then there are like tiny things like when he's saying all the names and then he goes like, oh, and hello to you, Steve. Like that, like it was just like, I added that on and it made, like I noticed it made it in. And I remember going like, oh, that made it in. Like I was surprised mm-hmm. because Daniel will just add in little tiny things that I improvise, but I don't think there's any like huge
stuff. To, like, it's just stuff that you forget.
I, like, that I go like, oh my God, I made that up and now it's in a Pixar movie.
Right. You know, like, yeah.
Some of that, but like, yeah, it was
amazing.
I was in Inside Out at 1 and 2 and Monsters University. I did a lot more improvising on those.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Monsters University stuff, a lot of it was improvised.
Wow.
A lot of my lines were just me joking around, saying stuff, and then they threw it
in. So how does it work? Because quite often in an improv situation, you'll have someone else to bounce off, at least one other person to bounce off.
One, it was I was like the sidekick. It was like Johnny was the bad guy, and uh-huh. I was Chet.
Yeah.
So I just kind of threw them a bunch of lines and just like would be like, you're crazy, Johnny. Like, you know, just like, the whole thing was like he was obsessed with him.
Right.
So I just threw out a bunch of stuff and then they would just like use them or throw them in. There's one, the line where like I'm coughing as I walk off camera and like I was clearly improvising and like trailed off, but they used it. And he like walks off camera while he's coughing. And I'm like, that's the coolest thing in the world that they animated that.
That's really funny.
And for Inside Out 1 and 2, I recorded with Paula Poundstone. Like we recorded together in the booth.
Oh, amazing. So why did they not do that for Hoppers?
Well, we could have got guys in the room. We would have fought each other.
Fist fought. Had it in her contract.
That would have been a much shorter movie.
Yeah.
Because I like to fight everyone.
Yeah, that's a lot of content fighting.
You can't tell this about me.
They wheel you in like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. You're like,
they wheeled me in like that. Yeah. They just took the mask and the shackles off.
Oh my God. If we were ever to make any sort of sequel to this, though, I would maybe try and be like, hey, what if we did like, what if you put us together for like an hour?
We'd have a great time. They would allow us not to now.
Yeah, I think
know
each other.
Amazing.
Hoppers 2, The Silence of the Beavers. Sure, they're going to love that.
They really are.
Blimey O'Reilly. Yeah.
Blimey O'Reilly. Hoppers 2, Blimey O'Reilly. It's The Silence of the Beavers. Very, very quick. Bobby, I mentioned Comedy Bang Bang.
Yeah.
You haven't been Fourville for a while.
Not in here, I have.
I want him back.
Me too. They have Fourville action figures now.
Do you get a slice of that action?
Oh, yeah. I'm living on that Fourville. I'm making that Fourville money.
Ask you make me if I know what that is.
I made $8. No.
You make the Fourville money and you make £150 a time for Psycho and Dallas.
Better deal.
Yeah, that is a better deal.
Comedy Bang Bang.
I've heard of Comedy Bang Bang.
Yeah, I play an orphan who stabs people.
He gets a bit stabby.
Yeah, he's a little stabby.
Of course he does. Yeah. What else? Yeah. What else would it be?
He's also a time bomb.
It's like five, but one less.
Yeah. And on that snort.
That's so
dumbest joke in the world.
I think we'll bring this to an end.
Yes.
There we go. Nobody's in the middle of the floor. That's good. No!
Just kidding.
All right.
He likes you.
I do.
Ooh, another abrupt ending. I should explain that I don't record all these interviews myself on my own equipment. I do some, but most are recorded in hotel rooms by other people. And this week it seemed that the fingers were a little bit trigger happy on the old stop button. But I'm sure you'll agree that interview with Piper Carter and Bobby Moynihan was a ton of fun. Just like Hoppers, in fact, which is out in cinemas. Go check it out. Last but not least this week is another excerpt from a spoiler special interview. Edgar Wright's action-packed adaptation of Stephen King / Richard Bachman's The Running Man, starring Glenn Powell as a man who takes part in a killer game show, has finally hit shiny disc formats this week. And to celebrate, I'm bringing you about 15 minutes or so of my spoiler special chat with Edgar Wright. The rest of it is available on our spoiler special feed, along with nearly 500 other spoiler specials. So if you don't already subscribe, give it a whirl at empire.supportingcast.fm. Now, this is a spoiler special chat, so do be mindful of that as we do get into it right from the off. Spoilers abound right from the off. And I should also say that there may also be an abrupt ending to this because it is an excerpt. But I will do my best to make sure it doesn't come mid.
We are delighted to be joined on the Running Man spoiler special by the film's director and, of course, co-writer Edgar Wright. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
Obviously, people are listening for Running Man spoilers here, but I want to start off by talking about a 1972 film called Skyjacked.
Oh yes. So,
which is in your film?
Yeah. So this is a sort of strange kind of, I wouldn't even call it an Easter egg because it was unintentional. So, you know, we started working on the script in early 22. So myself and Michael McCall, mm-hmm. who I co-wrote Scott Pilgrim with. And one of the ideas, there's a scene in William H. Macy's like basement. He's a sort of black marketeer and he has this sort of little underground lair where he kind of sells things at like cost to kind of, people who need meds and all sorts of things. Like, he's a wizard in the black market. Anyway, and he has these kind of cathode ray TVs, the TVs that don't watch you back. And we thought, well, what if an old movie is playing on there? And what if the old movie is like foreshadowing for something that happens later? So because the third act involves a plane sequence and a kind of like a hijack in inverted commas,
yeah,
we thought, well, let's have a hijack scene on one of the TVs. And so we were talking about the airport movies from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said to Michael McCaw, I said, oh, I'm sure there's this film called Skyjacked. And I'm pretty sure in this film called Skyjacked, this guy holds up a plane with a live grenade. And that could be the little foreshadowing thing.
And foreshadows a grenade as well.
There's a grenade. Yeah. Yes, it's sort of a two for one.
It's eight shadowing.
It's eight. Oh my God. You know, your brain got to that pun quicker than I did, and I'm now annoyed. Eight shadowing. Classic Chris Hewitt.
Thank you.
So I'd seen Skyjacked. I don't think Michael had seen, so he watched it and we found the scene and said, okay, this is great. And we'll kind of use this. We literally used a line from the scene in the screenplay and then cleared the clip. And then, the person holding the grenade, the person who takes the plane hostage, yes, in Skyjacked is James Brolin. So this is a long time before Josh Brolin comes into the frame for Killian and gets cast in the movie. But then when he does, it suddenly occurred to me. It didn't occur to me straight away either. It was like, I said to Josh, hey, you know your dad's in this as well. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, there's a clip of Skyjacked. And he goes, no way. Actually, in the scene is Rosie Greer.
Right.
Who is in that scene as well, who is Josh's godfather.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So actually when Josh watched it for the first time, he watched it a sort of screening near his house in California. And we were talking about it on the phone and I texted him and said, did you see your dad? He goes, yes, I saw my dad.
He gets a nice big close up.
I know, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a good, beautiful shot of him in that. Yeah, that tickled me immensely. I saw the film, the first time I've seen the film twice. I saw it the first time, but I didn't recognize it as Skyjacked. And then second time around, I did some digging.
Yeah,
I was like, that film, there's something about that film.
You know the one person who spotted it?
Yeah.
And of course he would, is Joe Dante.
Oh, of course.
But that's the thing, yeah, is I kind of think like only you would make that connection on a first watch.
It's a John Gillerman film.
It is.
There you go. So about 2 years before Towering Inferno, if I'm right in thinking. Amazing. All right, so that's enough Skyjacked talk for the time being. But you're right. I mean, it does foreshadow, obviously, what happens at the end of the film, but it also foreshadows a grenade as well. And the YVA sequence has probably been my favorite gag in the film, which is Ben going,
the why?
Yeah. Which tickled me immensely. But it's also...
I have to give credit to Michael McCall for that gag.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, Glenn.
No, I mean, I don't have to, but
no,
I
you should. You should. But it's also this really,
Michael,
really,
if you're listening, I love you.
Intense, sprawling action sequence. Listen to the regular podcast. Edgar shot that over many, many months in several different countries as well. Was that the hardest thing to pull together in the entire movie?
I mean,
just in terms of all your action on different levels, you've got Ben doing different things. He's on a roof. He's naked.
It was all difficult. It was a very complicated movie, and it's a lot of sort of moving parts, and there's a lot of to create kind of these like action sequences that traverse a lot of ground. It's a lot of work. So it's not the only like complicated bit in the movie, but it's one of them.
Yeah,
and also it's things like where you're just trying to be clever in terms of, you know, like shooting, you know, when Ben is looking out of the window and sort of giving voices to the kind of like the drunks outside the liquor store, you know, looking at Glenn was shot in like London at the set that you were on in Leavesden.
Oh my
God.
And
the reverse is shot in like Bulgaria, like months later. So there was like a continuity thing. Like we had the cast and crew the other day and I had to give the biggest hug to Lizzie Pritchard, our script supervisor, because there's like an enormous amount of work to keep track of everything, you know?
Jesus. Because there's a lot of stuff going on in that scene. And one of the things, because we are tethered to Ben's viewpoint throughout the entire movie, one of the things we never really get to see, apart from in the scene with Elton, where Elton literally calls the goons on Ben, we don't get to see who dobs him in. We don't get to see who tips off the hunters about Ben's presence.
Well,
I was wondering in that scene, is it Rich Hall?
No, actually, no, I don't think it is. Also, I mean, I'm the first person to mention Rich Hall as well. I think the Rich Hall is actually the first movie he's ever done.
Really?
Like, I mean, he's obviously done a lot of TV, and he was on Saturday Night Live back in the day. But I've known Rich for a long time, and we thought of him for that part. And I think it's funny, he came in to do ADR, and he said, I was surprised to get the call for the ADR. And I said, what's that? I said, I was so sure I was going to be cut out. I said, I'm not cutting you out, Rich. No, you know what? We honestly, I mean, it's something that Bradley says later. Bradley, the character played by Daniel Ezra.
Yeah.
He said, the network cheats. They can find anyone at any time. So there's an element where there are recording reports happening, where the public can sort of, you know, kind of snitch on somebody and get money. But it's sort of established by Bradley, who's the sort of super fan and the conspiracy theorist, that the whole thing is like a sham.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, it's why, because, you know, Glenn has that line to Daniel where he says, I don't understand. You could set up your grandkids for life with one recording report. And he says, you think the network would actually pay us that money or, you know, come up with some bullshit case and arrest us? Yeah. So basically it's the idea that, like, they're not going to pay out.
He's got a thing around his wrist, which tells him that the time at any given moment.
Yeah,
they're not they're not tracking him through that, or the tapes, which is something that's in the book, if I remember rightly.
I think it's that thing, you know. I mean, I think the honest answer is that we don't need to know. Yeah. Like Ben doesn't know; he's just paranoid. But it's not Stacey. You know, I don't think it was Rich Hall's character, but is it like the network are just kind of like cheating?
Yeah, because the Hunters are on him very, very quick in Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is like suddenly Carl Glissman's in the street looking up. Was that something fun for you to play with in terms of, you know, amping up the paranoia? You're keeping an eye out for...
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's something that's very vivid to me in the book, that sequence.
Yeah.
Where he's in the kind of the YMCA. YMCA in the book and YVA in the film, because apparently the C in YMCA took offense to the script. So, apologies to the C's.
You've offended the C's.
I've offended the C's again.
Yeah, again.
So, that was something that was really vivid to me from the book. And it always reminded me, the scene in the book reminded me of the scene in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with the super posse and the man in the white hat.
Yes.
Where, like, that's such a great movie in terms of those guys are coming and they don't seem to be able to shake them. And then, you know, another thing that's very vivid to me from the book is the idea that, especially in, you said, this, the narrative is tethered to Ben Richards. Another thing from the book that I really wanted to bring to the screen.
Yeah.
A lot of other films of this ilk will like cut back to the network headquarters or, you know, cut to Sheila and Kathy. And we did get notes about that, you know, script notes about that, about what about expanding the perspectives in the movie. And we were very, you know, sort of, we were very clear that we wanted to stay with Ben. And we thought that was more powerful and more intense, that you only have the same information that he does, you know, so you don't kind of like can't really like jump around to sort of see what's around the corner, you know. They play a little bit fast and loose within the YVA that you cut outside to the Hunters. But by that point, Ben knows that they're there.
And so could maybe say as part of the TV coverage as well.
Yeah, well, there's the Rovers everywhere. Yeah. Like, it's going out. Bobby T is commentating on what's happening.
Yes.
So that was that. It was so. It's really fun in that respect to make it that intense, but it does make it sort of challenging and freeing as well in terms of like keeping the focus on Ben Richards.
Yeah,
that you know you're living vicariously through him.
Well, there's two things I want to talk about developing from that. One is the opening shot. I'm always interested in opening shots and the choices of opening shots. And here we have the foundry, the factory that Ben has gone back to try and beg for his job back. And then you do a kind of you pull focus and you see Ben's reflection in the window. It's a really cool opening shot. What was that always how you began the movie?
No, actually, the first draft of the script. Me and Michael worked on the treatment together, and then he wrote the first draft. It started with Ben in the apartment watching Speed the Wheel, which is kind of how the book starts, that he's in the apartment with his baby. It was actually Simon Kinberg's idea. I forget whether it was before we sent it to the studio, but he said, what about having a scene where you see, because in the scene, he talked to Sheila about begging for his job back and swallowing his pride and doing something that you get to understand that something that Ben Richards is not doing lightly, going back to sort of like a dangerous job where he's obviously already had some major fallout with his employer and been blacklisted. So for somebody who's got a lot of pride like Ben has to go back and sort of like beg for work is a big deal for Ben Richards. And in the first incarnation of it, that was talked about in dialogue. And I think Simon Kinberg said, what about seeing that scene and opening with it? So we thought, okay, that's a good idea. So we actually, that was something that then came later, the idea of having that kind of like sort of cold open in the factory. But then it was the idea of like, and I think actually we went further. It was like, it started in a sort of, started on a close-up of Ben. And again, it was a thing about trying to expand it. So it was like, I tell you what it was, as I didn't want to get outside to have any exteriors. Right. I wanted to stay in these kind of claustrophobic rooms in the first three scenes. The first scene is in factory, like office, then a waiting room, then their apartment, which is windowless, and then you're in a hallway. And then finally, with the opening credits, you go boom and go into the world. And there's a lot of world building in the opening credits.
Yeah.
But it was, I didn't really want to have like a wide shot of the exterior of the factory. So that's, then I came up, well, what if you just saw the factory through the reflection on the glass and then pull focus to Ben for the first line? And so that actually, that scene in the office with David Zayas was the first, I think it was the first day that we did at Leavesden on the set. It was a very, very ambitious scene to do first because young babies, real babies in the shop. First time working with babies. And I got to say, really, apart from their amazing handlers, the amazing handler, Michelle, but also Chung Hoon, the DP, and Richard Graysmart, the first AD, are both fathers, unlike me and Glenn. So they knew how to kind of like deal with babies. And like, I mean, it was, that with those first scenes doing like the first three scenes with the baby was, I mean, it was amazing doing that performance of real kids rather than like a dummy.
Yeah.
Like, because it feels really real. And also you do have to sort of navigate through like a baby about to ball its eyes out at any second.
There's a moment during where Ben is watching Speed the Wheel. I'm so glad that Hammy made it into the movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I think on the there was a longer bit with Hammy that's on the deleted scenes. My girlfriend is in that scene as well. She plays Sean Hayes' assistant.
I love it. Where you see the little baby playing. What's the baby's name? I presume it's twins.
It was Sienna and Alyssa.
Okay. And they're just entranced. So I don't know what you were showing them at the time.
Oh, okay. I can tell you.
Okay.
So I think, yeah, because Glenn is having to get the baby. He's trying to distract the baby from crying.
Yeah.
Because the baby's been ill and in a lot of pain. So he's sort of trying to sort of coddle her. And she obviously went to sleep, but he's trying to sort of just sort of mollify her. And, you know, Hammy, the mascot on the show, is that kind of like a very. I had to explain to Michael Bacall what 3-2-1 was and Dusty Bin. In fact, when we were writing, we watched an entire episode of 3-2-1.
Oh, my God.
Which, if you've ever watched, I don't know if you've ever rewatched an episode of 3-2-1.
I haven't.
It is one of the weirdest, most obtuse game shows of all time. And then showing it to like an American who's never seen it, I showed him, we watched that and we watched an entire episode of It's a Knockout as well. For younger British viewers, I mean, me and Chris were showing our age now, talking about It's a Knockout in 3-2-1. But so Hammy was like our Dusty Bin. Dusty Bin was the mascot in 3-2-1. I'm thinking, well, if you have a giant hamster. I think actually in the script, I think it was written as being an animatronic hamster. So it was going to be a lot more like Dusty Bin size. I think it's my brother, maybe inspired by having seen My Neighbor Totoro on the West End. Was like, why isn't it a big? Wasn't it a big puppet? I think at one point it was going to be inflatable, and then it was like a big puppet. So the Hammy thing. So there's actually an extra bit probably on the Blu-ray because there's some sort of deleted extended scenes of like a bit called the Hammy dance.
Oh, that's amazing.
But did you see in the end credits as well that like sort of like Down with Hammy, Flush Hammy?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, you didn't see that in the end credits?
No.
I mean, amongst lots of anti-authoritarian
stuff.
Imagery.
Yeah.
There's a sort of shot of Hammy and it says, Flush Hammy.
Oh my God. I can't get on board with that. I'm sorry. I'm pro
you
network
can find
when it comes
a toilet
to...
big enough to flush that one.
When it comes to Hammy, I'm very, very pro network.
Oh yeah. To answer your question though,
oh, yes.
What was I
yes.
doing to make the baby engage with the TV?
Yes.
I had a stuffed toy like, I don't think it was a hamster, it was like a fox. And basically, Glenn would say, look at the fuzzy hamster. And I would, we'd play the music and I'd be sitting behind the camera waving this toy. And it would work for about 10 seconds and then they get bored. But that's what the baby's looking
you
at.
You got the shot. You got the shot.
Okay, that was slightly abrupt, but not too abrupt. But anyway, it was Edgar Wright talking about The Running Man, which is out now on all home ed formats and is well worth your time. And to hear more from Edgar, check out the spoiler special interview in full. Right, that's enough for me, and enough indeed from this week's edition of The Interviews. Again, a reminder to check out the regular episode of The Empire Podcast, which this week features me, Helen O'Hara, James Dyer, and Alex Godfrey, plus that interview with Maggie Gyllenhaal and Jesse Buckley, and all the film-related fun you could possibly wish to pour into your ears. Thanks for listening to that, and this, and indeed more. See you next time. Bye-bye.